This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest is the great actor and comic Steve Martin, the star of such films as The Jerk, All of Me, Roxanne, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Parenthood, L.A. Story, Father of the Bride, The Spanish Prisoner, Bowfinger, and Bringing Down the House. Steve Martin also has established himself as a novelist and playwright. Shop Girl, the novel he published 3 years ago, was a bestseller. He's now adapting it into a film. Martin's most recent novel, called The Pleasure of My Company, is coming out in paperback next week. If you're thinking it's a wild and crazy guy kind of story, it's not. But it is witty. It's about Daniel Pecan Cambridge, a man who has so many neurotic fears and compulsions, he seldom dares to leave his Santa Monica apartment. Terry spoke with Steve Martin last year about The Pleasure of My Company. She asked him to start with a reading.
This all started because of a clerical error. Without the clerical error, I wouldn't have been thinking this way at all. I wouldn't have had time. I would have been too preoccupied with my new friends I was planning to make at Mensa, the International Society of Geniuses. I'd taken their IQ test, but my score came back missing a digit. Where was the one that should have been in front of the 90? I fell short of the genius category by a full 50 points, barely enough to qualify me to sharpen their pencils. Thus, I was rejected from membership and facing a hopeless pile of red tape to correct the mistake. Santa Monica, California, where I live, is a perfect town for invalids, homosexuals, show people, and all other formerly peripheral members of society. Average is not the norm here. Here, if you're visiting from Omaha, you stick out like a senorita's ass at the Puerto Rican Day parade. That's why, when I saw a contest at the Rite Aid drugstore asking for a 2-page essay on why I am the most average American, I marveled that the promoters actually thought they might find an average American at this nut house by the beach. This cardboard stand carried an ad by its sponsor, Tepperton's Frozen Apple Pies. I grabbed an entry form, and as I hurried home, began composing the essay in my head. The challenge was not to present myself as average, but how to make myself likable without lying. I think I'm appealing, but likability in an essay is very different from likability in life. See, I tend to grow on people, and 500 words is just not enough to get someone to like me. I need several years and a ream or two of paper. I knew I had to flatter, overdo, and lay it on thick in order to speed up my likability time frame. So I would not like the sniveling, patriotic me who wrote my 500 words. I would like a girl with dark roots peeking out through the peroxide who was laughing so hard that Coca-Cola was coming out of her nose. And I guess you would, too. But Miss Coca-Cola Nose wouldn't be writing this essay in her Coca-Cola persona. She would straighten up, fix her hair, snap her panties out of her ass, and start typing. I am average because, I wrote, I stand on the seashore here in Santa Monica and let the Pacific Ocean touch my toes, and I know I am at the most western edge of our nation, and that I am a descendant of the settlers who came to California as pioneers. And is not every American a pioneer? Does this spirit not reside in each one of us, in every city, in every heart, on every rural road, in every traveler, in every Winnebago, in every American living, in every mansion or slum? I am average, I wrote, because the cry of individuality flows confidently through my blood with little attention drawn to itself, like the still power of an apple pie sitting in an open window to cool. I hope the Mensa people never see this essay. Not because it reeks of my manipulation of a poor company just trying to sell pies, but because, during the 24 hours it took me to write it, I believe so fervently in its every word.
Thank you. That's Steve Martin reading from his new novel, The Pleasure of My Company. Well, your character, although he's writing this essay on why he's the most average American, is very not average, wouldn't you say?
Very not. He's he's a young man in his early 30s. He's unclear in the book about his real age, which he doesn't reveal until the last couple of pages for a reason you'll find out later. And he's isolated. He's a kind of a benign neurotic. He has certain rituals. He can't cross the street at the curb. He has to find two opposing scooped-out driveways. He has to keep the wattage in his apartment constant at 1,125 watts. For example, if he turns out a light in his bedroom, he must turn on a light in the living room or kitchen, and it's only a three-room house. And this is a story of how his life opens up, finally opens up, as he describes himself, that he has narrowed his life down to keep everything out. In fact, his stated goal was to have so many rules and conditions that he could control everything that was coming into him, and then he would slowly open the doors one at a time.
Now, your character wants to get into Mensa, and he thinks they made some kind of clerical error, leaving off
right.
the number one before his 90. You also wrote a piece for The New Yorker about Mensa.
Yes. Like I say, there was a precursor to this.
Right, right.
And I think that I needed to start that way in order to kind of go back to that essay, revisit that character in my head,
mm-hmm.
and kick it off from where I left it off before.
What does Mensa mean to you? I mean, it's this group of people with high IQs get
right.
together.
I always saw it in this way. Okay, well, you might have a high IQ, but what have you done lately? And I think the real stroke of genius is in what you do and not in some score.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at it a little bit cynically. I have no cynicism toward any Mensa member, but it was just the way I looked at the world, that the accomplishments are what matters and not scores.
I'd be interested in hearing why you want your writing to be writing for the page as opposed to writing for the screen.
Well, I started writing in 1965, when I wrote little essays in college that later became a book I published called Cruel Shoes. And then I was writing for my comedy act throughout the 60s and 70s. And then I start in the late 70s, I started writing screenplays, co-writing them with, other writers, The Jerk and Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
Of course, right, right.
And then in the late, mid-80s, I started writing solo screenplays, Roxanne and L.A. Story and Simple Twist of Fate. And then I really have written a lot of screenplays, Bowfinger, too. And then in the early 90s, I really got a call from the New York Times asking me to write something on this. There was a discovery of a Michelangelo statue here in New York City. So I wrote a little parody of that and went into The New Yorker ultimately. Actually, the truth is I really enjoy writing for the page because it's an utterly different thing. You know, a screenplay is description and dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And a book is really about sentences and paragraphs and their structure and their rhythm and the use of words, the exact, precise use of words. You know, in a screenplay can be, you know, I remember one year I, saw a little list in a magazine of, the best lines from the movies this year. And they were all like, come on, let's get out of here.
The catchphrases.
Yeah, yeah. And, it's just a very different, what your best line in a movie is very different from a best line in a book. So it's a completely different enterprise.
You know, as an actor, particularly early in your career, your persona was usually very extroverted. As mm-hmm. a writer, your two novels are about really introverted characters. I just think it's an interesting contrast.
Well, I think actually that without being too boring, analyzing my sort of stage act, that character, sorry to talk about that in that way, but he was a bit crazy. He was a little, I was on stage, this very similar to this character, really. It's like on stage, I was really just expressing a perverse thought on the way the world worked. And I remember this one bit I did was that I was... I was so mad at my mother. I used to scream it, of course, because she wanted to borrow $10 for some food. And, there's some kind of link here between this character who just sees things in the odd way.
All writers talk about, facing the blank page and so on, but it really is true that the difference between being an actor and being on the set and being... working with other people is so different than staying at home and writing.
Right.
Do you like that more isolated process of writing?
Well, they complement each other so well because, like you say, movies are active and social and physical, and writing is solitary and personal. And I never wanted to be an actor who sat home and waited for scripts to come through the door. I mean, I just that'd drive me insane, waiting and hoping so I always wrote and I always did comedy, and I just liked I like the activity of it. You know, I just find that when I'm idle, which I always enjoy, I always find that something comes up, something pops up. So I'll get out the computer and start typing.
Do you think you approach writing with a different personality than the one you approach acting with?
I would have to say yes, because, you know, it's just so different. They are completely different. But I really think that my acting has influenced my writing, because as an actor, you finally, as you get a little better at it, you realize you're observing character. And you realize that it's the details that make character. It's the little tiny actions. And so in writing, I think I realize, or at least I like, to pick up those details that determine character.
And those are the same kinds of things you have to pick up when you're acting, too, aren't they? I mean, you're not
describing
them, you're doing them. Yeah, yeah.
Right. It's from acting. But the strange thing about acting is it's also what you don't do. I mean, it's almost a thought process in your head that is so expressive. So the more you can detail it in your mind, and without, you know, what we call in acting indicating an emotion. I remember once the director, Herb Ross, he was mad at an actress. And I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "Well, she's supposed to be mad. She's supposed to be mad." And I said, "Well, she's yelling." He says, "Yes, but anger has 1,000 faces." And I always remembered that. It's like, oh, yes, some of the angriest moments I've ever felt are when I did nothing or said nothing and expressed nothing.
Right.
So there's always those choices in behavior.
Steve Martin is my guest, and he has a new novel called The Pleasure of My Company. You know, I think it's hard when you're so accomplished at something to try something that you're new to, as you were new to writing novels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, you know, when you're at the top of your profession in one thing and then you're brand new to something else, you can fail, you can be flawed, and you can be very insecure. You have no track record. So did starting to write bring out insecurities that you weren't used to because...
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But there's a trick when you first start writing.
Teach it to me, please.
Well, you don't have to show it to anybody.
Right.
When you're sitting there alone and you haven't, you know, made a deal with somebody to deliver a book, mm-hmm. you're really on your own. And you can, it's like putting your toe in the water. You can have written something and you give it to a friend or you ask someone's opinion. So it never has, you always fool yourself because, you know, and the reason I say you fool yourself, ultimately you do want it to be out there. But you fool yourself by saying, it doesn't matter. I can be lousy. No one will ever see it if it's lousy. And, of course, they do see it, and sometimes it's lousy.
So you would agree that self-delusion is an important part of writing.
Very, very important. I really do. I think it is. It's like, I remember the first night I previewed my play, Picasso at the Lapin Agile. I'd never written a play. I'd written screenplays, but I was in Melbourne, Australia, and now it's 10 minutes before curtain, and all I could think is, what have I done? I didn't know if there's going to be a laugh, anything. It was just, it could have been so humiliating. But then only, 40 people would have seen it, and I could have gone home with my tail between my legs. But I just like to add that I really don't have a tail.
A Do you write many drafts before publishing?
What I do is I write without inhibiting myself. And then I will, a draft is not quite the right word in my head. I go through and I start editing. And I start reading it over and over and over which can get very tiresome. So sometimes I'll put it down for 3 months, come back, read it again. Then I'll read it aloud to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll read it to my dog. And I find that reading it aloud makes you catch every word. And to me, every word is important. Because I'm a reader who gets bored quickly. So I need to have these sentences on the move and be interesting all the time. So I try to catch everything.
Is your dog helpful when you're reading to him?
Well, he's my audience. I'm not looking for his response.
You just need somebody to read to.
Yeah.
Did you feel an obligation to be funny when you started writing? Because that's what people expect of you.
Well, no. Because the first book, Shop Girl, although it has funny moments, I wouldn't call it a funny book.
Right.
But in Pleasure of My Company, I actually wanted the book to be funny. And I knew that I had a character who could be funny. And I, you know, it's really, whenever I start even a New Yorker essay, I have the idea, I think, okay, what is the potential of this? I have no idea what the individual bits will be or moments or anything, but does it seem rich or does it seem I'm going to run out of steam in a couple of paragraphs? And I felt with this character, he could really keep going. And it's a cliche to talk about the discovery of character as you keep writing, but I found that my mind retains little details of things I've written 40 or 50 pages ago. And so something that you wrote that was very, very casual, a little aside, a little something he did, comes back at a certain moment and it becomes big. Because now this tiny little thing impacts something else, and it's like this, it's like weaving a web or weaving a something else, a caftan, I don't know, which I'm weaving. But that's what I really like, is where the details start to add up.
Well, you know, you've had your success in the book world and the film world, and you've been on the bestseller list, and you're probably the only person to have hosted both the Academy Awards and the National Book Awards.
I guess I am.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I'll have to stop any Oscar host from hosting the National Book Awards so I can keep my uniqueness.
So, I think that would probably give you a good seat as to some of the differences between the two worlds, the film world and the book world.
Well, the differences, the book world is much, much slower
mm-hmm.
than the film world. I mean, the film world is so oriented to promotion and getting the word out in certain ways, getting the word out in very vibrant ways and very specific soundbite ways. And for example, I mean, here I am talking to you for 40 minutes about my book. This would never happen about a film. I mean, in terms of the way a film is generally promoted, but it's the way books are promoted. They're talked about in depth in much slower ways.
Well, and the numbers are so much smaller too, aren't they?
Right.
Like a
right.
best-selling book probably doesn't come close to the ticket sales of a mediocre selling movie.
Probably, yeah. But you know what I found is that when I started writing for The New Yorker, I noticed I got more reaction from one essay, and I'm talking about actual reaction that I could feel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people saying things, than I did for movies, like entire movies that cost millions and millions of dollars to come out, and I would hear, you know, very little, or somebody would say, nice movie or something. But these essays, they started to, I guess it's because they're so intimate with the reader. They're so intimately involved that it stays with them longer. You know, a movie, sometimes I walk out, I've forgotten it, you know, as I'm exiting the lobby.
Steve Martin, speaking with Terry Gross last year. His novel, The Pleasure of My Company, will be released next week in paperback. Here's Steve Martin trying to impress the audience from his 1978 comedy album, A Wild and Crazy Guy.
Hey, I'm not trying to be a big shot or anything like that, but I get my drinks half price. That's right. For every one you buy, I get two. So I can just have about as much as I want. You know what I mean? And it doesn't affect me. No, I'm not on this step. Okay. I have had a lot of fun since I've been here. I do like coming to San Francisco because it's an intellectual town. And that's kind of what I'm into. I dig the intellectual kind of thing. And I had a good time since I've been here. I know that sounds phony because every entertainer in the world comes out, no matter where they are, and they go, "Hey, it's really great to be here." And it really sounds fake, but I am sincere when I say, "Hey, it's really great to be here."